The method.
Idea. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
If this is the first time listening to this podcast, it's part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
So we're into the 50s now, aren't we? We're into the sort of 50s. Second half century. I think it's episode 51. So for this episode, we were joined by the writer Claudia Durastanti, who is an Italian writer, although, as you will hear, she spent some of her upbringing growing up in New York. And we spoke to her when she was staying at a flat in Berlin on a sort of a writing, a bit of writing time that she had blocked off.
Yeah. I think she was there for a residency for a month, I think she said. So she just landed in Berlin, and so we talked about how place and travel influences her work and the relation between movement and the word. She's, as well as a writer, she's also a translator, so that also fed into her work and into our discussion as well.
She's got a very interesting attitude to finding a way of describing the kind of unique light of each place, and that she doesn't feel connected to it until she's worked out the phrase that describes the light. I think she was still in search of Berlin's when we spoke to her. Maybe she's found it now.
Yeah. By the time you listen to this podcast, she may have encapsulated the metaphor for the, I think it was the evening light in a taxi ride in Berlin.
So, yeah. She was in a very slightly echoey flat. Hopefully this all sounds good, but it was great to speak to Claudia, and here is our chat with her. So I guess we got an interesting angle to go with, being that you're in Berlin specifically to do some writing at the moment. So what stage of the writing are you at the moment, and what's your sort of what's your day looking like?
Okay, so I've been planning this new novel for 3 years so far, but I managed to write like 5 pages. So that's my process at the moment. And so I have this very convoluted trip back into the third person after using the first person. So right now what's happening is that I spent a couple of hours in the morning trying to fit in this third person. So I'm in the early stages of it, but this is happening after a long, long time spent thinking about the novel. So right now, I'm not really sure what the process is going to be, because I never worked this way, really. I usually think and write at the same time. After Strangers I Know, which was such a peculiar book for many reasons, a hybrid, unknown, uncharted territory for me, it's really tricky to go back thinking to a proper novel format, but that's what I want to do. I think the amount of time I spent writing, it's still not enough compared to where I want to go. So I hope this month here helps me a little bit with that.
In that period of planning for the last year, have you, other than the 5 pages of the novel that you've got down, have you been writing notes, or have you got, notebooks filled with ideas, or is it purely just been a process of thinking about it and you now have to translate it onto page? Like when you've come to Berlin, have you brought files and things on your computer that you're going to work from, or it's just a case of a blank page and what's in your head?
No, that's interesting. Definitely fragments, notes, very short notes, and maps I brought with me in a way. So I have paper maps. I'm working, do you know these stereotypical, that's what I brought with me, TV shows, crime TV shows, when you're trying to put all the clues together. So I read once that Francis Scott Fitzgerald used to hang his notes like on a clothesline with hangers, so with characters and stuff like that. I don't have enough space to have a clothesline. So I used to have in Rome a wall with all the because the structure of the novel should be a sort of battleship. So I need to figure out where, you know, the X and A's letters and numbers are matching in. And so that's what I brought with me. I literally moved battleship labels in a way. And so this is not my flat. So I need to find a way to have it space-wise visible. So this is a little bit different compared to how I used to work before. So I used to think a lot about timelines in all of my books. This is more about space, really. So it has to really have a physical matching of how I'm thinking about the novel.
I guess there's lots of different ways that can work in terms of what, I mean, you mentioned maps. Obviously, that's quite an easy sort of two-dimensional representation of something. Exactly. But in terms of the notes, I can imagine there's lots of different ways you could arrange those on the wall, or lots of different ways you could format the notes. Do you have any process so far in that you find you're sort of writing one piece of paper with a character and their characteristics, or is it more around the themes of the novel, or I don't know how do you go about breaking down something as with as much depth as a novel into fragments?
So I had a lot of notes since I'm very bad with plot, I try to do my best effort to plan sequence, but that's the least interesting part for me. So in every piece of the puzzle of the battleship, I try to have in each page both something about character, something about landscape, the ear, and then what happens. But what was interesting to know is that I was going along and thinking this would happen here and this happens here. I managed to switch and to move them and to rearrange it. So the early stage of it is like translating the notes I had in these sort of containers, in these sort of boxes. But then when I do that, I'm not always satisfied. So each box or each page has sort of lines where I delete stuff and I move them. So this is why the kind of physical representation of it is helping me, because it's helping me thinking about rather than effect, cause, consequence, or time, really is helping me to think more about spatially, where is the character at that time? So this is what I've been doing so far. So translating the notes I had in each little box, all of these containers, and then moving them around.
I was just going to ask if the maps and where you're setting it, is this a physical space that you've actually been to, or are you using the maps to kind of plan your way around somewhere you're not familiar with?
No. So I always write about places I left a long time ago. So my early novels were all set in New York, Brooklyn, New Jersey, and I haven't been living and consistently in New York since I was 6 years old. Then I wrote a novel in the outskirts of Rome when I was living in the UK after 8 years that I hadn't been living in Rome. To me, in a way, to have access to, since to me, writing about space, geographies, and landscapes is way more intimate than writing about family and love affairs or physical relationships. So to me, space is very sensitive and dedicated. And so it needs a wide stretch of time where you kind of have glimpses and glitches and memories about it, but they're not consistent and they don't form a sort of unified scenario in a way. It's a little bit when landscape switches into being a dreamscape in a way. You know, it loses a little bit of the borders and materialities of it. So I've been living in Southern Italy most of my life. I briefly wrote about it in Strangers I Know, but I never really addressed that space with novelistic thinking. So what I have in the book is a unity across almost a century and a half of the new book. It's the only constant in the book is the area in Basilicata where I grew up in. But I haven't been living there consistently and I haven't been visiting there for 3-4 years. So as you imagine, it's an intense process of almost space travel in a way. I have to recompose what I think I remember of it, but I am not researching it being there, if that makes any sense. And I'm also resisting traveling back to visit my mother, for example, which would be conventionally good for the book, I think, because you then have, you know, this very sensuous experience of being there with the light and the sound of it. But I think in this early stage of writing, I don't, my approach, since it's not an historical novel, but it's based, you know, it starts in the midst of the 19th century. And usually I thought, oh, I'm going to read as much as I can about that time. Then I'm going to leave it for a while and then I'm going to start writing. What I'm doing is the opposite. I write and then I try to verify if what I'm thinking or imagining has some sort of connection to history or what happened. So, for example, the novel is a little bit about oil. And I didn't know if actually they were digging oil at the time. I wrote scenes about it. I think about it. And then I went after a month and a half to see if that was. And I said, oh, I got lucky. But then this is quite messy because if it didn't make any sense, I would be forced to delete the scene. And so that would be such a waste of time. But somehow I don't feel comfortable with writing after knowing, if that makes any sense.
So some sense of accuracy is still very important to it, though. So you do have to verify. You wouldn't keep an anachronism in if it served a kind of metaphorical purpose.
So that's a sensitive spot for me. So linguistically, I'm trying to be anachronistic. I've seen, I don't know if you managed to come across it, I think it was released in the UK. There was an Italian director that adapted Martin Eden. And so by Jack London. So the film is called Martin Eden. He translated it. He moved it from Southern California to Naples and Geneva. And the timeline is very sketchy in the sense that you see cars, you see signs, you see whatever clothes that could span from the fascist era to 50s or to the 80s. And usually when we see these kind of anachronism or blurred timelines, that happens often, of course, in dystopia or utopia, but it's hard to see it, you know, in different sort of projects. And what I wanted to do, and I have the lexicon, for example, of revolution in Italy or counter-revolution in the 70s in the early part of the novel, which is set in the mid of the 19th century. And then I have very old-fashioned, backward talking in the last part, which is set in the future. So I'm trying to see if I can convey the sense of glitches in anachronism, not through characters or not through timelines, but with our understanding of how language evolves over time. And I think that's what fascinates me. So I don't want any level of accuracy there. But as for, I would say, technology or oil or what was really happening material-wise, I'm more embarrassed in a way. I feel that if I want to put a factory in there at that time, I have to make it sure that there's a river next to the factory, which is, you know, something I wouldn't do. Who cares? I don't want to have a factory and explain how it actually works, but I'm trying to put an effort in there. But I don't know. I'm trying this out since it's very, very new. I don't come from the kind of writing since I was always obsessed with, you know, ambience, interior, inner landscapes, or psychological dynamics between characters. To me, it's quite challenging, and I'm not sure I'm really compelled by it to see how things work. So in terms of accuracy, I don't care about it in terms of plot, or I don't care about it in terms of language, but I do feel I need to be more careful when it comes actually to big objects like oil or factories or stuff like that. Or there's a lot of bombings and explosions in this book. So I've been reading, you know, books about fuel, about how bombs set off. And even if they don't end up in the book, I feel like I should, you know, if I'm so obsessed with this kind of dynamic, I should know a little bit about it.
Like getting that balance when you're working with the real world, but adding in sort of speculative fictional elements, you want to have some balance. If you go fully speculative, it can veer off too far, but having the right mix of reality in there is important. With the maps that you draw, are you verifying them? You say you wouldn't go back to have the actual experience of being there, but are you sort of looking on Google Maps or look, you know, is there a river there and going online to verify that? Or are you writing everything first and it's only once you've got a few pages down that you then go and check? So that seems as a writer, it seems a lot riskier to my instinct would be like check it first and then write rather than write all this. Like, oh no, there's no river there. Damn, I'm going to have to delete all that.
What's so funny about this, I recently interviewed for an Italian literary supplement, Jennifer Egan, and she came back with a book. I don't know if it came back because it's not a sequel, but it's a book that evolves around her early novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, which was from 12 years ago. So she came out with The Candy House. Same characters in a different span of time. And she said that she didn't reread A Visit from the Goon Squad. She worked from scratch on what she remembered of the characters. And then she went full on, finished novel. She goes back to reading the old one. Mm. She got a lot of things wrong. and she couldn't keep them in the new book. And she said, you don't understand the amount of stuff I had to. Even if it worked, I was it. And so at that moment, I felt a pang of pain, you know, about not the loss of time, but in a sense, a loss of characters, of ideas, of something that, you know, really worked. And then I started thinking, what's interesting about this sort of sacrificed pages? And I think in the way I'm working right now, there's this sort of leftovers. So if I get something wrong, then I deleted it. It cannot be there any longer, but some part of the energy of it, some things still stay in a way. So it is a process of exploring stuff and without the fear that, you know, I would have to go back. So it's the first time perhaps for me. I was always a very determined writer in the sense that I used to think about pages even in my sleep and then get up in the morning and write and they would come fully formed. So I was also bragging when I started writing books. Oh, I didn't do a lot of editing. You know, my books, my short stories, everything is fully formed. I make my editors happy because I know exactly what I want. And this is the first time. This is the fifth novel where I'm actually a little bit more insecure in a way. And so when you were asking about maps, I did definitely, there is a river there. I've been there a lot of times since I was a little girl, but my memories of it almost turned it into this sort of mythical river that was way more stronger and powerful and longer and also very hard to cross. I would do that with my mom when we were walking. And so when I went back there to see it, I think 5-6 years ago, it was this very modest, you know, tiny river. It's like when you go back to see the old house you grew up in, you know, that it's a castle. And then the more you visit it and the more it shrinks, that happens to me when I go to Brooklyn all the time. And so the palace or the mansion that my grandparents lived in, now it's basically a shed in the yard. So that happened with the river, really. And so my memory of it is one thing. The reality of it is another thing. But since I'm writing about that same course or stream of water 200 years ago, I can imagine a little bit and make it, you know, different even compared to my memories or the reality of it. It turns into another river, if that makes any sense.
And with the fact this is your fifth novel and you're doing this in quite a different way, you're not waking up in the morning with the page fully formed, what has caused that? Is that an intentional decision to work in a different way to see what the results are? Or is that because this novel wasn't quite realizing itself in that way?
I think because there has been a major game changer in the sense that I come from fictional short stories and novels. And then I wrote this book, Strangers I Know, that was kind of blending different genres. And somehow, even if I, as I said before, I was uncharted territory, I came to it with a very assertive voice that was fully formed in a way. So maybe it was a lot of years in the making. I've been thinking unconsciously about that book for 10, 15 years, also because I didn't want to write about my family openly. So perhaps the resistance I applied to writing in that book, it built a sort of compression within me that when I started writing it, I was very secure about the tone and what I wanted to do. After that book, I think when I say a game changer, to me, I was really afraid that it would completely, it's like when you lose yourself in the woods. You have to be very careful with first person narration in a way, because if you don't plant, how is the little fable that you didn't put the breadcrumbs behind you. You're not going to be able to find your way back home. So I think that I forgot a little bit how to put these breadcrumbs and see, oh, I'm going to fall into this first person, but I'm going to find my way back out. So it was very painful for me in a way to realize, do I trust third person narration? I come from that. I come in Italy. Also, we have a past tense called passato remoto. So the literary form for writing is third person in this past tense, which is the classic form. I come from that. And then it felt almost like it's not that I didn't trust it. I completely forgot about how to use it. So this is why perhaps with this book, the method I'm changing is not so much because I want to do it this way, but it's because I don't know how to do certain things anymore. So it's almost about learning again, riding a bike. And I think it is fascinating because it helps me to get rid of certain habits I have in writing. With the tone, for example, the first draft, it's only 5 pages, but I have different drafts of these 5 pages. The first draft had a tone that was my usual tone, this sort of hypothetical thinking. The character is there, but it constantly thinks, oh, what if I did this? What if I was there? And this kind of melancholic vein. But it didn't match because I wanted the opening to be way more picaresque, adventurous, and explosive. And so I think, oh, this is me trying to wear my same clothes while I'm traveling into a different world. And so I tried undress from that tone and try a tone that is a little more goofier for me, but it's also more fun for me because it's new in a way. And so I am not approaching this by any way with a precise voice, and I'm not approaching it with a conscious way of saying, oh, I'm going to do things differently. In a way, it's partially because I'm forced to do it this way. And there it has, as I said, its limits, but it has its own benefits. I have writer friends that are intentionally committing to writing a different book all the time. That's their kind of project. I always felt I was going to be stuck in the same lost American neighborhood in all of my writing, that I would be always about a woman, a girl, an older woman, but always around me. If you think my other novels in Italy, one is called A Chloe per le ragioni sbagliate. Chloe is a name close to Claudia. The second book is called Cleopatra Goes to Prison, the third one, and the character is called Caterina. So I've been working even with, I was so lazy that I couldn't even come up with names that were different from Claudia. And it's funny because in Strangers, I know, I think there's only one time that I mentioned myself because the book is based on this kind of elusiveness about the self. And so for me, what's even more simple with this new novel is the fact that I'm coming up with different names, which sounds banal, but to me is almost revolutionary in a way. There's no C in this book. There's no character named C. Yeah.
Do you find then that it's sort of, so the note taking, the map making is that the sort of first step? You put things up on the wall and have the very sort of top level or the basic ideas, rearrange them, and then you sort of redraft those 5 pages again and then go back, put new, rearrange everything on the wall again and redraft it. So you're kind of going through those steps to try and find the voice that will take you on to page six. Is that a good characterization of the process?
Yes, and it is actually true because I keep going back and forth almost with this feedback and relay system. I don't know, this is another technical thing I should know about, but I pretend I know about it. And that's what it feels to me, that I put a sound out in the room. The room has things to the properties, their sort of feedback, and then I got it back. In Strangers, I know I mentioned that kind of Alvin Lucier, I Am Sitting in the Room experiment. So he's uttering a sentence, he records it, And then he puts the tape again in the tape machine. He pronounces the sentence again, but it has in the feedback the noise of the first time he says it. And he goes on recording, over recording, over recording until it becomes a different, complete kind of sound. So when you asked that, I was thinking that to me, going back and forth from the page or the representation of the novel I have with these maps is constantly, you know, a process of, write, check, verify, switch, then go back to the pages, and then that's it. And in order to move forward, I need to accumulate a good bulk of, you know, good bulk, 5 pages, let's say, but until I get them right, and then I can move on for a little segment in the, you know, in the tape, and then I move forward, which is painfully slow. And as you imagine, it's not ideal for everybody that, you know, it kind of pushes you to write quicker, but I think it has interesting consequences.
Do you envisage then that you'd move, you know, once you're happy with pages 1 to 5, you'd move on and do the same process for pages 5 to 10, or would you, once you've got the voice set for those first 5 pages, the rest of the novel just flow and you'll write all the way to the end?
No, I think it's going to be more this kind of thing, working in short bolts until it gets right, and then that, and then I presume that, and I'm already seeing this, that the other segment or chunk of it is going to be go back and forth until it sets it right, and then it goes. I don't see it. I understand why you're asking, but I don't see it. You get the first note right, and then it falls along, which is something I always thought, which is interesting. I always felt that if I had the good opening line, I could spend years to find a good opening line. But once I had the opening line, it would come through. It's not happening. No. And more and more, I am interested. I write about music. Music has been very important for me in a sort of compositional process. But if I have to make a comparison with the fully formed page, often it was like, you know, a 3-minute or 2-minute punk song, which is really knows what it wants to do. And it shouts it and it goes da 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 da, and then you have it. And this is a little bit, I guess, it sounds very grandiose the way I say it, but it's more symphonical writing, perhaps. When you think about symphonies, you have different parts of it. And then often you work, there's years between one part and the other part, and there's a lot of going back and forth until it all comes together. And this is completely new for me.
I'm only the lowest doorkeeper. At every hall, there's another doorkeeper. Each one more powerful than the last. Even I cannot bear to look at the third one.
From what you've said, the space and geography obviously it plays a big role. But in terms of the process, it's what you've described is mainly within your room. It's within the confines of the wall and the page. But are you sort of taking new notes, sort of going for a walk? I mean, you're in Berlin, in a new city for a period. Does that change? Are you sort of spending the morning rearranging on the wall, writing, and then stop, and then spend the afternoon walking the streets and taking more notes that feed into that? Or do you kind of compartmentalize the writing and that process, and that just stays in the room, and then whatever you do in the city is irrelevant to the process of writing this?
Yes, I was always a travel writer, I think, in disguise, in the sense that often notes carried through urban movements, you know, traveling, riding trains, visiting different cities and countries and planes. I was very, when I lived in the UK, I was moving back and forth to Italy oftentimes, and a lot of people say, oh, where do you feel more comfortable writing? And it was airports, because I was spending a huge amount of time there. But of course, the past couple of years had to change a little bit that. And so I think I am not writing about the pandemic by any means. I think the only traces of the pandemic in my writing are in my translations. I work as a translator as well. And so I have no notes about what was I going through in the past 2 years and a half. But if you read my translations of, let's say, Animal Farm by Orwell in English into Italian, there's some words I choose in the phrasing of the Italian translation that are come from the media discourse around the pandemic. So the decrees became, it was reminiscent of all of that kind of political bureaucratic talking about the pandemic. So I find it fascinating that my personal notes, my journals are into translations. But going back to your question, since I've always wrote about different, about time, as I said, I had this kind of very, a huge part of my writing was absorbed about the question of time lost, memory. With the pandemic, I started completely thinking about another dimension, which was space, really, because it was, you know, I was confined and all of a sudden it felt that time disappeared. And my main preoccupation was with movement, space, being inside and outside. And so I think that's what shifted my interest with this new book in really thinking about the slow transformation of space in a way. But all of a sudden, I was missing my sources because being a travel writer in disguise, imagine I felt like the desk anthropologist when, you know, anthropology as a discipline was born. You had all of these professors that were writing about foreign tribes from their desk. So all of a sudden, I felt a little bit this kind of academic traveler. But this is interesting in the sense that it almost leads you necessarily to this transfiguration of what you think about a place. And then you, it's also, let's say, if I was really thinking about fake autobiographies or hybrid autobiographies with strangers I know, it almost felt I was thinking about fake travel journals right now in terms of what do I remember of this place? I no longer have access to it. I don't have longer access to certain walks. I don't longer have access to this physical exploration of the world. So what am I going to do? How is it going to change for me, the writing? And one thing I must say I miss, although here, of course, I'll be taking walks and visiting and stuff like that. But one thing I noticed I missed while traveling less or being outside less, it was that my objectives became poorer. So in a way, I felt I lost a texture. So I traveled in the past few months. I was so happy. I went to LA to promote the book. And I remember that I felt a lot that the air around me was both made of milk and ashes, which is something that makes no sense, perhaps to no one except me. But the milk and ashes image brought me back to a sort of landscape in Southern Italy that I'm writing about. So that kind of perception I had in Los Angeles ended up in the novel translated into another space. So that's actually what I miss, what I look for, and why it is important for me to be outside and not always at the desk, because I think it makes, especially the objectives, if that makes any sense to you, it makes writing way, way more physical, like the images you would use, even more than sound. I would think it's more about texture and how you just breathe, if that makes any sense. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's an important part, having that travel and the experience of a place to connect it to some experiences.
And also, I find I don't understand cities until I don't have a definition for the light of the cities. So when I was writing about London and Strangers I Know, I remember for me, the color of it, it was a sort of infrared lilac. I remember that. When I travel to New York, I have a very strong perception of the light there. In Basilicata, where I grew up, then the light to me is like a lung full of blood that has a hard time in coughing out blood, which I know sounds gross, but that's me. So yesterday I was in a cab in Berlin. I see this beautiful light and I don't have any words for it. And I don't know if I come up with it, but to me, it's almost until I have a settled definition of the light in a city, I feel, or in a town or in a sort of landscape, I don't know the place. I realize I'm very light sensitive.
Do you have like a notebook that you carry with you when you're in LA? And like, at what point did the milk and ashes metaphor spring to mind? And do you sort of immediately jot it down, or do you pull out your phone and write in there, or do you just make a mental note and think, tomorrow when I get my desk, I'm going to write milk and ashes on the computer, or how does that process of capturing the idea and retaining it work?
You said it. Notebooks are turning into this the equivalent of water bottles for me. I have 200 water bottles that I never carry with me. I have a collection of that. You know, there's a cemetery of water bottles in my apartment. And notebooks, I keep buying them, and they're almost all blank. Because then the automatic thing I do is I take the phone, I put it on the phone, and notes, which I hate because it's also ugly in a way, as the format is that kind of yellowy thing that is trying to make old American yellow notebooks. And so I put it there, and then I translate it in on my computer. So it's really two machines talking in my handwriting. But I do have this is interesting. Notes I take on the phone. The notebooks, when they're not blank and I carry them with me, I realize that when I'm outside, it encourages me to write longer stretches of text. So last summer I was traveling and I wrote a short story in a train ride of 40 minutes. So it feels almost at the page. I remember when I was studying in college that everybody thought that the computer would lead, writing on a computer would lead to massive novels. You know, everybody was going to write Ulysses because you didn't have, you know, you wouldn't care about the delete function. It was a it was very naive to think that, because what really writing notes in computers has really made the fragmented form to explode. Mm. So what we thought what was going to happen, that we were going to have this, you know, huge stream of consciousness novel thanks to the computer, didn't happen. And I realized that when I'm on paper, I do these long hands, like really, really long segments of text, whereas the phone, where I could, you know, it's almost an extension of my body, I could easily type and type in, because now that's easier for me to use a pen. It's easier to use a phone. And it's keeping me short forms, like really short flashes of intuition compared to writing by hand, even if it's more difficult to write by hand. There is American author Lauren Groff, which writes all of her novels longhand. But then she says that she writes different drafts of the same novel longhand, and then she burns them. I don't know if this is true, but I think it's a cool story. She burns them in a fire in her garden, and then she goes to the computer. And then I don't necessarily believe that she remembers a novel when she writes it on the computer. But still, to me, it was interesting the fact that she would write everything longhand. And she's not, you know, from a generation of Philip Roth and Don DeLillo. I understand they would write with a type machine or by hand. But it's interesting to me to see that this computer phone writing didn't go into the direction we all expected 20 years ago.
And how are you technically writing the 5 pages that you're working on at the moment? Like, is that on a computer or are you writing by hand?
Yes. So it's notes that I have on my phone, then this map that I write by hand on the wall, and I switch, and then I have the computer part. So the ecosystem is made of these three elements. Yeah.
Do you kind of categorize when you're taking a note? I mean, like milk and ash, that's related directly to LA. So, I mean, I'd imagine, you know, you're going to look at that and go, all right, yeah, I remember LA. I'd imagine there's other notes that are sort of vague or nebulous, and what they relate, they might be part of this novel. They might be something when you come in 5 years time to be writing a novel about your time in Berlin. You don't know where it's going to fit. Do you sort of do any categorization from the notes, or is it just you just have a big list of notes and then you sit down and pick the bits that strike you in the morning and put them up on the wall?
This is exciting because I never thought about it, but now I want to write about it because I think it's interesting. The notes I have a common, like milk and ashes. Then I have a name of a bar. Then I have my bank passcode in the same note. And then I don't know why, instead of writing on the same note, I switch them, but I don't categorize them. So if I go back through time, now I have 5-6 years of notes. I do find lines or notes that ended up in Strangers I Know or ended up in this novel, but they are not categorized as literary notes. They are in the mixed and blended with everyday life observations and banalities and numbers and stuff. And so I used to love, but I do sometimes still try to do it, write writers' diaries, notebooks, and journals. So I was going back to Sontag's notebooks, and sometimes you would feel weirded out because it's not proper journal taking. She would, for example, have a long list of words she feels fascinated by that time. And so it's mysterious to you. You would read this long section of adjectives of words with no comments, and then it's just a list of words randomly. Then it's what happened to her today. Then it's a short chunk about a book she read and she had to review. Then there is something nasty about someone else, and that's it. And so I feel that sometimes when we look to notes on our phones, we do have that. We have the word that we pin down because we are so impressed by it. But then we have the bar we went to. Then we have the kind of, you know, I need to remember this. I checked in this place for this reason, stuff like that, the appointment with the dentist. And so it's interesting to me because I think that's what actually what happens when you read our notes, but somehow writers like her were already working into this iPhone, I'm saying iPhone, like phone format, like in the 60s. Yeah. So I translated a book that is very dear for me. It's Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights. If you read that book, most of the time you're wondering what's going on or what's happening, because part of it feels unfinished letters to friends, notes to the self. There's a lot of addresses in the book. And so it's not a proper memoir, but there's the addresses of the house she has lived in, and people who knew her when they read the book, they said, oh, she drew kind of a precise topography, even though she never mentions herself. She makes everything elusive. We know that the husband is Robert Lowell. She never mentions him. But it was interesting that she placed herself in space through the precise address of the houses she lived in. But going through the book, you would find materials, like random materials that make no sense there, that are almost like shopping lists, you know, like eggs and milk and stuff like that. And I, as a translator, I felt at loss sometimes because I never want to talk to writers I translate. I want to do my own thing, and it's good when they're dead. But with her, it was a problem because I wish I could pick up the phone and ask what was going on here, you know, what was happening, because it's such a mysterious piece of work. And so if somebody in 50 years goes through our, you know, notes on the phone, it would be interesting in terms of archaeological work. It was going to be difficult to separate what ended up in a novel, what's, you know, about daily life, or what's a mix between these two things. Yes. So there's a lot of talking about, I have friends who are involved in digitalizing the emails, the new letters, you know, writers, they're so obsession that with you would have to do it with emails and emails. I do think that text, like phone texting, is way more relevant to that purpose, but phone notes also.
Yeah, I think there is a whole hidden world there for, I mean, some people, I guess, don't use notes, but most people have these, even if they're not writing, if they're not writing, there is that sort of hidden world of notes of just the bar you went to. And I think most people would put some ideas down in there. It's then, I guess, the writers take it that step further to create a world out of it.
Don't you think it's dissatisfying when people are writing consciously notes with the purpose of publishing them? I think there were a couple of experiments there to publish a novel that was notes through the phone. And over there, it gets, I guess, a little tricky because you're already taking them with a sort of editing thinking within. So I felt those kind of experiments were not so compelling.
I think that could get quite gimmicky.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a fascinating world that didn't, I mean, I guess people could always take notes in private and keep them in a drawer in the house, but the ubiquity of phones and the ease of creating these notes, that, you know, the billions of people on the planet all have this world of notes hidden away, kind of, which the, you know, the text message interactions or, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, that's, it's not hidden in the same way because you're actually conversing with someone, whereas there's a sort of mini conversation going on when you're putting notes in, but it's hidden from everyone else. And one question on the translation side of things, do you sort of, I mean, obviously very different processes. Do you sort of have different places in your head when you're sitting down to translate or sitting down to write? I mean, you mentioned you like to write in in airports or when you're traveling, would the same apply to translation? Like, say you arrive at the airport, your flight's delayed for 3 hours. Do you think, oh, great, that's 3 hours I can sit and write, work on the novel? Or do you think, oh, I've also got that translation project. That could be 3 hours to sit and work on that. Or does translation just, that just happens when you sit down at your desk to work and the novel's more fitting in around gaps?
No, so I'm the most boring translator at the desk that it exists, because all of my airplane translation is terrible. I remember due to a forced time mismatched agendas, I was translating Donna Haraway, which is very difficult to translate. It's not something you can do by intuition, by ear. You need to have reference text. You really need to sit down there. And this happened also with Book of Numbers by Joshua Cohen, which is also a maximalist novel that requires a bit of research when you're translating. And so I remember that I was with Cohen's book. I was touring for the book. I was shortlisted in a prize. I always had to be in buses. Like, it was, you know, kind of a tour life intensively, but I had to submit the book to the publisher. So I was translating in cars even, which was a nightmare, you know, as a car was writing. I had all the other writers that were, you know, chilling and say, what are you doing? I was like a maniac like that. I was translating IRA on a little boat going to an island because I was supposed to go to holiday with my friends, but I didn't finish on time. So this panicky stolen hours of translation are a mess. And I still can retrace in the translations, which is funny, where I was at that time and how come the rhythm is kind of fucked up. And so this is why now I make sure that I need to sit on my desk, be in my flat, not even in a hotel room, not even anywhere else. You know, I have a very now academic approach and boring approach to translation, because it's true that it's also rewriting and it can benefit, you know, about, I always have this romantic idea of thinking, oh, Natalia Ginzburg, maybe when she was translating Proust, she was, you know, in islands here, she was there and there. Well, how does, you know, the traveling influence the translation? But it doesn't feel it works for me. So I need to be in the smallest room possible to translate, if that makes any sense.
Surely not the smallest room possible.
the smallest room. So over here with this writing residency, I'm not going to be translating at all. No.
And do you only write yourself? Do you only write prose in Italian?
Always in Italian. I write nonfiction in English, which feels a little predictable in a way. When I'm not perfectly bilingual in the sense that my English, I never studied in school. So it comes from family, interactions, intimacy, traveling, but it's not by the books. So I always feel an imposter when I write in English. And this is why I didn't translate Strangers I Know into the English, because I would never have submitted the text. I would fall the temptation to overwrite it, to edit it. To me, being traveling across languages makes you feel like a spy almost. You're always worried that somebody's going to come up to you at one point and say, oh, we know you're a foreign agent here, you know, you're alien. I could see this here and here. I'm trying to learn to think that the writing that comes out of it, it's way more interesting. If you read my nonfiction in English, you can tell there is some impurities that come from the Italian. And my Italian prose, since the beginning, when I first published in Italy, my first novel, they said, oh, this is a translation of a dead author. A man, I remember that was interesting. They said, she must have stolen the manuscript of a dead man, American man, and badly translated it into Italian. So my first critic's reaction was, this novel is not Italian. She wrote and she stole it in English, and then she translated it badly into Italian. Because you can tell that there was a ring under my Italian prose that was in English. So it took me like 4 novels to learn how to write in Italian, which could be perfectly in disguise and thought of as an Italian book. And so now that I'm doing I write short stories slowly and increasingly in English, but it's a fascinating process because I'm always worried and also interested in the way, when is it going to be a full English short story? Or it feels it never lands properly into that language, if that makes any sense.
do you feel any of that in Italian as well? I mean, you grew up in your earliest years you didn't grow up in Italy. You were in Brooklyn. Is that right? So you came to Italy. Were you like fluent in Italian from birth, or was there a switch at some age when you were a young child that you suddenly had to start learning it? Italian. And does that still, do you still have a sense of, oh, I'm not fluent in Italian in some way? Or I don't know, maybe that doesn't apply.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I used to work in a music magazine, I would hand out my articles in Italian, and then the chief editor would complain and say, this doesn't sound right. And somebody else would say, oh, but she's half American, but I left the States when I was six, you know, so it didn't really apply. And then that was the first time when I said, oh, but I am also the daughter of a deaf woman who was never fully fluent in Italian, neither in English, and she speaks in a very peculiar way. So my syntax in Italian was deeply informed by my earlier years of life, which were polyphonic, because I was born, yes, in Brooklyn, but most of the people in my family were Italian migrants, not educated, that never spoke Italian. They spoke dialect and they spoke American slang. So they were unorthodox. It was a black market of language. It was always, always this sort of deafient and minor language. So I came from Italian dialect, American slang, and then, you know, not sign language, but the language of deafness. So when I moved to Italy and I was enrolled in public school, what happened to me was happens typically to a lot of children of migration, that they try to learn the official language of the country they move in the best way possible. So I made as a challenge for myself to start to write and to read into Italian perfectly in a way, which meant by the books. And I try to delete all the traces of my mother's tongue, which was like literally my mother's broken Italian. And this is why it felt so surprising as I would, you know, graduate from college, start working, I would write, and then my novel comes out and people says, oh, she stole it from an American author. Or where does she come from? You know, this is not right in Italian. I said, I put all of my efforts to write in good Italian. What's happening to me? Like, what's betraying me? Almost like it was an inner bomb. And that was a game changer in the sense that I really resented this for my first books because I felt it was a common of, you know, not knowing to write, not knowing how to use language well or literary wise. And then I understood that this kind of impurities and not landing fully in a language, what was made it, you know, it ciphered that language in my own way. And so what's happening right now is something that I never used to do. I was really, I don't know about you, disgusted by word plays or puns or anything that made language play with itself. I was not that kind of writer at all. I am reader at all. It would really disturb me. And now I realize that I come up with a new novel, I invent words. And I have so much fun with it. So I think my most Italian writing is coming now that I meant word in Italian, if that makes any sense. I feel so confident that I can make up my own words in it. I would never do that in English, though. Not yet.
Do you have puns in Italian, or is that something that you avoid? Because I've heard lots of people with other languages say that they don't really have it. And I think that's to other languages' credit.
not really. So imagine, I'm always fascinated by the Italian translator of Ali Smith, which, you know, the last cycle of books is one pun after the other. And so it is like a big detective game in that case, because you don't have an equivalent. It just sounds bad if you come with something made up in Italian that doesn't exist. So you really have to try to make the English pun, keep it that way, and try to make it sound fun, which is really, really hard in a way, because often, sometimes for me, they're not even fun in the source language. So imagine trying to make fun something in the landing language that you don't really get in the first one. You know, that's interesting. When you're a translator and you're fully fluent in English, sometimes people will ask you about the original pun or wordplay or something in English. And they would assume that since you know English, you understand it. But I think even for you, the English language is so full of, you know, things that don't make sense. It's full of mysteries. I often translate lately Irish authors, and I understand English, but I don't understand what's going on in their heads, you know. So it's frustrating when the Italian publisher or reader or journalist keeps asking you as a translator, you know, tell me the sense of it. And I am like, not even the author knows it, probably. You know, it's not because I know how to read English that I am entitled to understand what goes on. So sometimes with translation, this is kind of unrealistic expectation that everything has to make sense in the end.
I agree with the puns and wordplay can, yeah, it can be a very cheap trick within a book or in language. Yeah, it can be funny if it's a comedian on stage sometimes, but within books that's pushed to the forefront, and the wordplay or pun is what it's about. It can cheapen everything else. But then at the same time, I think there is something about language. It is speaking English. Obviously, there's maybe more scope than on other languages. But the idea of words having multiple meanings, and those meanings, the shortcuts and links between those words, I mean, that is what makes language, it gives it a texture and a shape that's different from other ways of describing the world. It's like in a scientific naming structure of the world, you sort of say this is an electron, or this is whatever, and each word has to have a definition that relates to one thing and one thing only. Otherwise, the whole structure doesn't make sense. Whereas implicit in the way language is set up, you're going to have words that have multiple meanings, or multiple meanings with different words. You have choices to make, which you don't in other ways of describing the world. And that seems intrinsic to what you're doing when you're putting words one after each other on the page. But where the magic of that lies is you kind of have to do it more subtly than doing, oh, look, I've made a pun, look at me, because then it cheapens everything else.
Yes, also because, as we said before, when you turn notes into novels, you do it with this edit thinking, you know, it's already formed. And so puns come out with that kind of, not shock value, but, you know, you're pretty confident and assertive that it's going to have that reaction in a way, in that sense, is gimmicky. Whereas when you find accidents between words, or when you, by accident or mistake, unleash their potential, that's fascinating to me. So with the translation of the title of La Straniera, that became Strangers, I know funny things were happening. So the Finnish translator of the book was not immediately happy with the translation of the title, because in Italian it's La Straniera, which means, you know, the stranger in the female. It's singular. When it was moved into the English because of Camus, the stranger, the outsider, we had to come up with another title, and it became a very I love the title, but it's problematic because in the Italian it doesn't have the I. Even if it's a narration in third person, I'm talking about another character. So Strangers I Know puts the I in the title. So it changes even the genre of the book, I think. In English, it's way more literary nonfiction and memoir compared to the Italian title, which is more ambiguous. But anyway, so it becomes Strangers I Know. When it's translated into Swedish, they don't move from the Italian title, because I think they have the same issue with, you know, L'étranger, Camus, and they take it from the English. And so it becomes Strangers I Know. But Kennen in Sweden, in the Swedish language, is an interesting word because it's knowing, but it's also knowing by touch. And so she said, I was not satisfied about the title, but since it speaks about body talk, about deafness, about multisensorial understanding of language in the world, I find that knowing canon in Sweden has this kind of tactile property to it that is not in the English, is not into Italian. So it's an added layer that unleashes a potential that was already there, or at least I like to think that it was already there. So that's what to me is intriguing in being a writer that is very influenced by translation. So when I write, I think about these things constantly more than I would think, oh, I'm going to use a funny word, or I'm going to make two words blend together, thinking that is going to have, you know, this kind of exciting and laughable reaction to it. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's those sort of words that are next to each other that are, there's relations, but they only become apparent after a certain amount of consideration or moving things around. And it's like, oh yeah, that now that has another resonance to it. Was the resonance there before, or was it created by the work? It's hard to know. Like you're talking there of the Swedish kan it? Is knowing? Can it? Which, when you were saying that, it brings to mind like kin in English, like obviously relating to family, which I guess has another resonance. And that, yeah. I don't know if in Swedish there is a word kin that has a similar meaning or not, but the way that words sort of stack on top of each other or next to each other, there's a sort of, to me, it feels like there's a spatial relationship in some way, but it's not one that can ever make sense because it's always switching. And this word, at one moment it's right next to another and they're more or less the same, and the next it's on the other side of the universe and in a different work. Or
how my mind works, you said that about kin, and you said kin, I was thinking about Shakespeare when said there's no kind in kind in kin, there's no kind in kin, which is very, it's a nightmare to translate in Italian. But then when you think about kind and kin, I thought about Stranger Than Kindness by Nick Cave, and the original title of the book was A Stranger. So I did this as you were talking, and thank you, because without conversation, this doesn't happen, you know, to any of us.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to Claudia for talking to us. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and you can find more in the program notes or on our website at unsidemethods.co.uk. You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
My writing is at jamiebatchin.com. I'm on Twitter at jamiebatchin, and I'm on Instagram at jamie_batchin. And if you could remember to like and subscribe the podcast wherever you find it, and if you are minded to give us a review, we're told it all helps.